when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi folks, I'm Jack Kennedy and welcome to another episode of Farm Tech Talk, the livestock show. No water in the fields as the dry spell continues into September, but plenty of talk of dirty water at the nitrates meeting. Shout out to our supporters, Arnua, the European Milk Forum and Grassland Agro for helping us make this show happen. In a minute, I'm going to talk to Adam, Darren and Aidan about what's happening in the fields. But before we go there, as per normal, we'll start with the quickfire buzz around. So let's get straight into it. Remember, email your questions to farmtechtalk@farmersjournal.ie or WhatsApp 086-836-6465. Adam, I've three quick fire questions for you. First one, why would a suckler farmer have dirty water in the winter? Talk to me about why a suckler farmer would have dirty water in the winter, Adam.
Yeah, I suppose, Jack, it's a valid question because when we think of dirty water, we think of maybe dairy farmers and dairy washings. But the thing here is, that I guess, on a silage pit, Jack, where you're pulling silage out of the front of a face and bringing it into a shed, there's all those bits of silage maybe drops down on that silage yard. And heretofore, a lot of suckler farmers would have captured that water via the channels that went into a slurry tank. But the new rules are saying that we need a different tank to store soil water. So whether we need to build an extra tank or not, there's a bit of confusion around there. So that's why we're a little bit worried about soil water.
Okay, nice one. Second quick fire. It is a man closer to my heart. Can we still use round feeders on rocky ground? Can we still use round feeders on rocky ground?
Yeah, I suppose once soil doesn't become liquefiable, Jack, that's the big one in terms of cross compliance. And look, it's very difficult, no matter what ground is like, to be having a round feeder and for soil not to get, you know, very, very liquid-like around a round feeder. So unless it's been moved very, very often, look, you're maybe looking for a bit of trouble now.
Yeah, I'll keep it in the yard, says you, and collect it. Last one now, and it's a long one, Adam, and it's a bit of a kind of a, it's a take from our last show last week. I'll read it out and we'll just get a thought on it. How can Justin McCarthy or anyone else contemplate a suckler quota? Suckler farming is, as everyone knows, a low profit enterprise. If I want to increase cow numbers in the future, I or anyone else will first have to buy quota, which will be overpriced. This will increase farm debt. Whatever money that I will be given in the scheme will be paid to a creditor. There will be no gain for suckler farming in such a scheme. It will add more regulations, paperwork, and it will increase the cost of production. Suckler farming does not need such a scheme. What suckler farmer needs is cattle that are finished on a grass alone in a marketplace that will pay more for beef that is reared on land that didn't come about because of deforestation. And a proper carbon audit where hedgerows are taken into account and carbon sequestration by grass. Adam, it's a long one. There's no real question to it, to be honest with you, but maybe I'll stick a question on the back of that in terms of, was there any more traction on that kind of suckler quota piece or any more kind of comments around that whole policy piece and the whole where we were going on that?
Yeah, I suppose, Jack, maybe look, there's to and fro. There's farmers rang that agree with it. There's farmers rang that would have disagreed with it. I suppose the at the very, very beginning there, I suppose that person is talking about a quota, whereas this is maybe a compensation package. It's not a quota as such. Maybe if that person had 20 suckler cows, Jack, we'd be saying that person gets a payment of 6,000 a year for that quota. And if they wanted to go up in cow numbers in terms of two or three, then they go out and purchase maybe that quota or lease that quota or get that quota from the National Reserve or whatever. It's not just as clean cut as a quota as such. And look, we'd all love to be getting a better price, Jack, for our beef. But when we go to a global market at the moment, in terms of minced beef, there isn't that many people that differentiate between different countries' beef. We'd love to think there was, but you're really trading on a global market and there's challenges within that.
Okay, thanks, Adam, for that. Darren, looking at you next. I have two questions here again for the quickfire for you. Ask Darren if he thinks hogget prices are coming back. I saw the best of hoggets with nice brackle faces making €190 a piece this week.
I suppose, Jack, what the best are and beauty being in the eye of the beholder. Look, there's no doubt this hogget prices have steadied. They probably have eased back a small bit, but the special sales are still strong. I was in Donegal last week, and I suppose the top grade of hoggets made from 220 to 260. Definitely from the start of the season, hoggets might have eased a small bit, and in a lot of sort of normal sales, your top quality hoggets are somewhere between 180 and 220. So that person is probably right in saying they came back. But I suppose it's subjective as of how good of the quality the hogget was.
Exactly. Yeah. Best is best as you in the eyes of the beholder. Second question for you, Darren. Ask Darren, is this the year to tidy up Colliers? So, I mean, now when he's tidying up, I suppose he's not dagging Darren. He's probably selling them, is he?
I'd say so, Jack. And look at definitely the year. Like, if we look at where the Collier trade has been at all year, record prices, like Collier prices may be eased by 10 cent this week on the back of 2 week kills. The last 2 weeks kills were over 10,000, but you're still your general prices. It's a factory price is 340 to 350 a kilo sort of thing. That's 70 to 80 cent above this time last year. That March trade for that real heavy, say, flesh Collier is probably back maybe a bit easier to the tune of 5 to 10 euros, but there's still a lot of in big heavy yaws, Jack, between 135 and 170. A medium yaw somewhere between sort of 110 and 120 or 130. I would be getting rid of any passengers this year. Just going a long way to replace them.
Aidan, looking at you, two quick fire questions in for you as well. The first one is Aidan working for the department now? Why is he suggesting farmers should get more inspections? When did you talk about farmers getting more inspections, Aidan?
I don't know where that's coming from, Jack. Now, you know, I think I mentioned, I asked the question at the webinar on the night threats was, you know, about slurry storage and stuff. That I do think a lot of farmers do need more slurry storage, but I suppose, look, we do need compliance is my point, I suppose, I think I was making that night. So,
okay, I hear you. That's probably where it's coming from. Yeah. Second question, is the Moorpark Open Day going ahead?
It is by all accounts, yeah. So they're driving on for it. I think the announcement in the last few days by the government is probably positive for Moorpark. I don't know the exact dates, but yeah, it's definitely on it.
Yeah, 14th, 15th, and 16th. And I think they're allowing up to 4,000 per day at each of the on each of the days. So full steam ahead is what I hear. Adam, moving back to the sucklers for the main show in terms of a couple of questions from this week, what you have in the paper. We've probably covered off enough in terms of the suckler cow quota policy or not quota, as you said. Like, I mean, there's probably still some development to come on that, Adam, in the next couple of weeks as the kind of cap thing comes to life again.
Yeah, obviously farm organisations, Jack, are making their proposals and making their submissions ahead of that CAP consultative deadline next week. So I think, you know, we'll see all those come to fruition, and there'll be a lot of debate around them as regards what the detail is in them and where farm organisations see the future of the suckler cows. So look at this, it's by no means a closed book, and obviously farmers will be discussing that as well in the coming weeks as to what direction we take.
Yeah. Beef trade, Adam, give us a kind of a snapshot in terms of what's happened.
Yeah, we're pretty steady, Jack. 415, 420 for bullocks, 420, 25 for heifers. Factory procurement officers looking for cattle. We're seeing big developments in the UK, Jack, or across the water in Britain. 14% a kill down there in 2 weeks in August. And that's putting pressure on supplies over there. And that's turning, we'll say, some of those, in terms of demand back to us. So that's why we've seen a steadiness in the trade. Look, I think factories are playing games back there 3 weeks ago, trying to pull the price back. I'd say you'll see the price kick on a little. We're seeing Aberdeen, Angus and Hereford stock very, very in demand at the moment, 15, 20 cent breed bonuses. So I think it's positive. And I look at around the mart rings, factory agents are giving way in excess of what cattle are worth in factories. So, yeah, it's all pretty good, Jack.
The live exports, Adam, I mean, you have a piece there. Did I see? Are the numbers back a good bit now for this year to date?
Yeah, funny, we're tracking not too bad, Jack, on 2020 levels, but I guess 2020 was an extraordinary year in terms of where exports were way down. So if you want to get a real picture, I suppose, of exports, we go back to 2019, and we're back about 40,000 head if we look on back at 2019, which was a normal year for exports. The big one there is the Netherlands, Spain. Those countries are down based on calves, but the big positive in all this is the Northern Ireland. We're up 30,000 head in Northern Ireland if we compare back to 2019, and that's a lot of Finnish cattle are going up there in terms of filling that hole. Wholesale market hole that's been left because of demand in the UK for supermarket spec beef. So that's a positive. But yeah, I suppose looking at it in the overall picture, you'd be a little bit concerned in terms of there's a lot more extra calves kept in the country in 2021 as compared to 2019. And if we look at our beef trade at the moment in terms of supply and demand, that's one of the reasons why our beef trade is good at the moment, because we've got a reduced supply coming online. So if we have, we'll say for 2022, 2023, you'd be a little bit concerned there with a low level of exports this year.
Okay, I hear you. And that'll take come into effect not next year, the year after probably.
That's it exactly. If we look back across the last 10 years, Jack, if we have a good year for exports, generally 2 years down the road, we'll see a positive year for beef price. So it's a little bit concerning maybe ahead.
Adam, we talked to Declan in terms of, I suppose, those I call it Butty Herefords and Butty Angus cattle that are coming fit now, we'll say, we're in September now, but coming fit in September, we call it at low live weights, 500 kilos heifers or something like that, coming into 250, 260 kilo carcass weight. Like, I mean, any update in terms of what you've slaughtered yet down in Tullamore or in Tribe, just on the Tribe farm outside Cashel, or where are you?
No, we've another few to slaughter there Monday, Jack, and look at, I suppose that's we're going to actually delve a little bit deeper into this, because we've a webinar coming up next week, next Thursday night, the 9th of September at 8 o'clock, and we're going to really delve into I suppose in terms of what cattle we've killed so far and the challenges associated with that system. And look at this farm, there's 140 cattle down there, Herefords, Angus's, Limousines and Belgian Blues. They're all high dairy beef index, so you would say to yourself, geez, we're starting off here with a fairly decent product in terms of looking for a high DBI index. They're all AI sire progeny as well, and yet look at, I know N is equal to 1 and all that, but we killed a heifer last week at 268 kilos dead at a 5 minus at 17 months of age, Jack. And I suppose it's very frustrating in terms of the industry where it would be pointing you to in terms of grass based and get animals killed at a young age and get them off the farm and a low carbon footprint and a low cost and an in-spec carcass. But really there's no future in that in terms of where we're going there. If we get more of those heifers at a 5 minus, we can't work at that, because really if we were to kill her at a 3 plus, Jack, or a 3 equals, we'll say an in-spec fat score, she would have been back at maybe 220, 230 kilos carcass. That's out of spec for any market. So it just shows you the challenges. And look, there's a lesson there to be learned for everybody, I suppose, in terms of drafting those animals. A lot of new people in this system. We lost 36 cent a kilo on her. We lost a quality assurance payment and they went to town on us on the grid. And look, I know we probably wouldn't do it on that farm because it's a demonstration farm and we want to be able to sell cattle on the grid. But if you were a farmer and I had maybe more of those animals, I'd be definitely looking at a flat price for the next time, and I'd be shopping around to see could I get a flat price on those cattle. Now, look at, I suppose Declan maybe argues the point, and it's a good point. Those first cattle that we draft every year, that they don't tend to be the best cattle. You might say that, geez, these must be the best cattle now because they're finished the earliest. Mm-hmm. They're not. They're, as you say, they're the smallest, the buttiest, and we'll generally get into good cattle maybe now for the second draft and the third draft.
Okay, I hear you. Like, so that webinar is coming up the 9th of September, so that'll be interesting for anyone. And as you say, it's just to watch out for those, as you say, those smaller type animals that are coming fit quick to move them, or else you get, as you say, you get slaughtered on price. Adam, the other piece that lads can watch back on is, I suppose, lads and ladies, is the nitrates webinar. I mean, we've we've done a full nitrates webinar on it, and I suppose there's a realization coming, Adam, that it's not just a dairy problem, that the dirty water, it could affect a lot of dry stock guys if they put up some little bit of a separate tank to collect that. Like, I mean, a lot of your clientele wouldn't have been in that space or wouldn't have kind of recognized that there might be an issue like that coming down the line.
No, Jack, absolutely. I suppose this would have gone across people's heads maybe last week and the week before when we broke the details on it in terms of where the nitrates really were going. Because once you hear of dirty water, as I said, you think of dairy farmers. But this could be a huge challenge for beef farmers in terms of where we're going, in terms of silage pits and taking off that water off that silage pit. As I said, especially up around the country in the northwest, Jack, we tend to have loads of storage, and we tend to have been collecting that stuff off a silage pit and going into a slurry tank. But it wouldn't make sense to me at all to make that farmer that already has adequate storage on the farm to build a separate tank for soil water. It would sort of defeat the purpose in terms of, because all that will happen, Jack, is that farmer, he will get his contractor in and they'll take the water out of that soil water tank and they'll put it into the slurry tank to mix it, because that water that generally goes into that that slurry tank will leave the slurry a little bit easier to spread. And look, we'll need that in the future, Jack, because all slurry will say, if you're over 100 kilos, which isn't that high a stocking rate, will have to go out by a low emission slurry spread. And that's a trail and sure dribble bar, so it'll need to be very thin.
What's the dribble bar like up around your country? Is there much of it in use?
There is, Jack, but we tend, maybe some of them smaller dry stock farms, maybe you've an odd bit of net and you've an odd bit of bale and twine, and geez, you've contractors now, you'd get flurry language out of some of them in terms of what they hit maybe on some farms. Trail and shoe isn't an option up here, I don't think. It has to be that dribble bar, and maybe the trail and shoe is better, but I think up here it's a dribble bar. And look at, Jack, they're fairly heavy too on the back of machines. If you're on tough ground, it's a big weight to come out, but you need the big wheels on that tanker and you need a fair tractor to drive it too. You're not going to go up the hills of Cavan and Monaghan with a 390, you know, you're going to need fair horsepower in front of you.
Thanks, Adam, for that. Darren, looking at you, in terms of, you look at the time of year, you see straw moving on the roads, on the motorways around Ireland. Like, I mean, we talked before about, you know, slats for sheep and maybe the scarcity of straw was going to be a problem for a lot of sheep farmers. Is there any kind of an update on that in terms of, have your guys got kind of enough of straw, or are they getting straw this weather, or kind of what's happening in that space at the moment?
Yeah, Jack, most fellas are probably getting their hands on straw. It has been a good year for, say, yield. And I know there's, say, a lot of talk of straw going into the straw incorporation measure, but I think the fact that farmers, say, tillage farmers, got straw is allowing the majority of farmers to still get their, say, the requirements out of their regular suppliers. You're always going to have a situation of next February and March where there'll be some fellas that haven't sourced straw. And I think that's when the catch point could be this year, because I think that the fact that, say, straw is moving 17 to 20 euros out of the field for a round bale, a lot of farmers are buying, and maybe there's less going into sheds. So maybe I would be thinking that farmers should be buying at the moment if they need it.
Yeah, no, excellent. Darren, in terms of prices, what kind of movement have we seen this week in terms of, first of all, talk to us about in terms of factory prices and what has moved or hasn't moved?
Yeah, this time last week, there was probably a start of an increase of 5 cents to 10 cents. Sort of came in over the weekend and the trade has sort of steadied at a high price point. There's been no real change in the last few days in factory quotes. Look, there's a big range, Jack, like the base quotes in some plants are 6 euros, but that's kept down because of producer group buying. General on the land prices is somewhere between 620 and 640. And like, it's a great price this day of the year, Jack. Like, for prices that have increased the last 2 weeks, because again, the total trend, prices are euro kilo above this time last year. For B, I did a bit of analysis. Looking at, say, the first 32 weeks of the year, prices were 140 a kilo above this time last year. Like, that's 30 euros on a 21 kilo carcass. It's exactly where sheep prices need to be. Like, I know we often joke about sheep farmers being going out to buy and that type of thing, but like, I think in the last week, it's really hit home the fellas who have gone out to buy a bit of fertilizer, especially the highly stocked fellas, to spread a bit to try and build autumn covers, and also. There's more sheep farmers in the market for a bit of concentrates to start feeding to, say, lambs to keep them pushed on now. So, look, great to see. And I think the prices that have held this long, they're going to hold at this stage.
Okay, yeah, no, you're right. The inflation is eaten into the increases across the board, not just the sheep side of things. Like, so the cost inflation is definitely eaten into it. So it's not making it as profitable as it might seem. Darren, I've talked to the nitrates to Adam and Aidan a good bit already, like, you know, but I mean, it's definitely an issue. Like, I mean, there's a lot of kind of mixed farmers with sheep and a few suckers and that kind of thing, that if that dirty water piece comes out as proposed, like, it could mean a kind of a fairly significant investment unless there's some kind of a change on that piece. Like,
yeah, Jack, like and look at even on our webinar, say at the start of the week, I think this, a lot of farmers are probably haven't woken up to, or maybe woken up isn't the right word. A lot of farmers don't realize on the sheep and beef side. Dairy farmers, yes, because they're used to the soil water thing, but a lot of other farmers, they might have a tank, there's a bit of soil water going into it. Sheep farmers, by their nature, there isn't a huge amount of them, say, making a sheep only, making a pick, but it's going to affect a lot of mixed sheep and beef fellas if sort of that bit of around storing a bit of, say, silage, storing a bit of dung, that type of thing out in spring. And fellas might have to look at doing a bit of shed alterations or cornering off a bit on the yard. But I think, look, the big thing is that we get some clarity around that before next week, because then it really hits home as of exactly what's needed or what implications it's going to have.
No, definitely. We'll watch this space. Darren, Tullamore, can you give us an update in terms of, you know, we talked about in the quickfire there about hogget prices and where they're going. Have you bought hoggets or your lambs for Tullamore, or are you breeding your own, or where's that piece going?
A bit of a combination of buying and breeding, Jack. Sean was happy last year. We went to buying just your lambs, and he was happy out of that, that they've come on well this year. Yes, we're taking maybe slightly lower of a lamb crop than our hoggets, but looking at the price, and I have to sit down and do it exactly, but I think we're as far on getting the extra year out of the lambs. This year he's bought in Carrick in the Mayo Mule and Greyfay sale, and we bought last week in Donegal Mule Group. He had two bunches in from Carrick at 130 and 135, a batch in from Mayo at, I think it was 135, and then his two batches in Donegal was 124 and 142.
At what kind of weights, Darren?
The weights generally sort of from 37 to sort of 44 kilos was the heaviest batch out of Mayo. The Donegal lambs, there's one batch lighter. They'd be back. I imagine he's only getting them, say, into the weighing scales now. There was no weight up on the sale for them.
Okay.
But I imagine somewhere between 33 and 37 kilos, Jack. We're going to actually look this year very closely and weigh all the lambs and see what impact that has on breeding and conception rates later on in the year. We did a bit of work on it last year, and the stronger lamb we had, because we're only breeding for a sort of 3-week period on your lambs, the stronger lamb, it did show up. But look, we only had 7 or 8 to what in lambs, so it'll be interesting to see this year exactly how it goes. But Sean is busy down there at the moment. We're selling away lambs as well.
Right. And Darren, like, you've a bit to go before you start breeding. Like, I mean, you're not some of the early guys for kind of early February are letting rams out now. I mean, you're not in that space, like.
No, look, Sean got them lambs in. He has the first two batches that he got from Carrick and Mayo. They've been sheared and they're on good quality grass now. And like, they won't be going to the ram until the start of November. Yeah. His main run of sheep is sort of aimed at lambing down from a sort of the 15th to 17th of March. Leave it sort of a couple of weeks and then bring in your lambs. He doesn't want too long of a prolonged, say, lambing, because he'll be into AI breeding on the cattle side and that, into AI on the cattle side. So generally, we'll do 5 to 6 weeks on the ores and about 3-3.5 weeks on the lambs, maybe push it out to 4 weeks.
Okay. Darren, did you buy any new rams?
Yeah, bought two, Jack. We actually bought
big money, I suppose. Big money.
Well, sure. Look, we have to give back, say, some of the higher lamb prices to the pedigree lads to keep them happy as well.
Go on, tell us the truth now.
He bought a Suffolk ram, and I won't tell a lie, but I think it was around 800. You'll say, Jesus, passing on 800. I should know exactly, but no, I think he bought a hogget ram. 800, and he bought a nice Shirley ram lamb, 640. So okay. I think next week I'm down there to start next week. So look, we do a good bit on videos and bringing up to date on what we have. What he had, he had to get, say, a couple of rams because they were up in numbers. And I suppose one of the things that every farmer's came in, we've gone down keeping some of their own Texas, and a lot of farmers have said, but you're a lot of mule lads, you run a Suffolk ram, is there any difference? Look, we're going to run them with 30 yo hoggets, see what it's like, see if there's any difference in lambing difficulty or that type of thing. He'd be a grass-fed hogget. This wouldn't be your more traditional Suffolk, so it'd be interesting to see what the difference is.
Thanks for that, Darren. Aidan, looking at you, in terms of, I suppose, the nitrate side of things, like we've talked a good bit about it, we'll say, on the nitrates webinar on the Monday night last week, and farmers can watch back that webinar if they want in full. I mean, there was a good bit of clarity needed, especially on the soil water piece, which will mean a big investment for a lot of dairy farmers, it's fair to say, if you need to separate it from slurry.
Yeah, Jack, and I mean, I wonder, is that going to be in the final document that the department publish and that they send to Europe for verification? You just wonder, you know, can something happen with that over time? Because, I mean, really, like, it doesn't make sense. There's no scientific reason why, if you have enough storage for both soiled water and slurry, that the two can't mix together. And there are lots of farmers that have that. So, like, it just doesn't make sense. And whether it's going to be a case that it needs to be approved by, you know, these FAS advisors, these FOSS advisors that, you know, the Chagas are private consultants are, that they need to sign off on that yes, the farm has enough storage and yes, it can be mixed. Is it something that's going to happen? I don't know. I think they're also going to clarify on what constitutes soiled water. Is it specifically dairy generated soiled water from milking parlors and holding yards and that kind of stuff, or is it going to be all soiled water? Because that has huge repercussions as well for not only the beef side but also dairy farmers that have large silage pits, that they're going to have to collect all the water off that now and keep it separate to slurries.
I mean, the other one, and we probably didn't mention it much on the nitrates webinar itself, Aidan, was, you know, the reduction in bag nitrogen, the reduction in fertilizer. That's probably going to hit the dairy guys more so than kind of even the beef or sheep guys that we're talking to, you know. So, I mean, that's going to reduce feed growing on a lot of farms. Is that fair to say?
It is, yeah. It is on the ones, Jack, that are maximizing what they're allowed to spread at the moment. And like a lot of intensive dairy farmers are, particularly those that are following the kind of best practice, you'd have to say, and maybe don't have outside blocks. You know, I often go to farms that are, you know, all the land is in one block, and maybe they're contract rearing heifers. And like, sure, it's a dream scenario for most farmers to be in that position. But the reality there is, in those farms, that they're fairly well stocked, then they're at 2.5 or 2.6 cows per hectare, and they're probably spreading up to 250 kilos of N across all their holding. So they're really going to be affected now, particularly if they don't have clover providing some of the nitrogen. In other situations where maybe you have 20 or 30% of your farm that's outside block, you know, generally they get an awful lot less nitrogen than the main block. And on average, those farms are probably spreading, you know, 225 kilos of N per hectare across the whole holding. And now their maximum is to probably 225, or, you know, depending on if it's 15% or 10% reduction. So they're not under that much pressure by this new rule, but those that are spreading 250 at the moment are. And like, there's no real way, I'd say the department aren't going to change that. And like, looking where the Moor Park research is going, all the talk there is of 150 kilos of N as kind of the new target for a lot of the research farms. And I look, let's be clear, they're nowhere near it themselves, but that's kind of the direction of travel. And unless you've clover that's going to provide a lot of the nitrogen that you're not getting in the bag, that's a serious reduction in feed. And it's kind of, you know, like, it's counterproductive in one sense, because if that farm then, you know, has to feed an awful lot more feed in the form of either imported silage or imported meal, they're bringing in the nitrogen in another source, so it's still being used, it's still being recycled, but it's not in the chemical form, which is probably the more efficient form, you'd probably have to say.
And the farmer producing his own feed. I mean, you were down at a farm walk recently down in Dunmanway, tough country, I'll say, like, and high rainfall in parts of it and heavy soils, etc., and that kind of thing. I mean, that farmer, I think you gave him he had an award on the grass 10 piece, like, and that competition that you run. But I mean, how will the nitrates affect him, or what do you reckon his changes he's going to make, we'll say, and tell us a bit about the walk.
Yeah, so that's John Galvin's walk from Dunmanway, as you say. Now, he's on right good ground, Jack. He's very close to gravel. It's well-renowned in the area. It's been a really dry farm. He burns up in summertime. Like, the land there is very, it's up and down, it's hilly, but there's some great land in between the outcrops of rock and trees and forests and all the rest. But his land is good. He's fortunate in a good farm. So in terms of nitrogen, well, just to give you a bit of background first, he's got 35 hectares in the block and he's milking 105 cows, so a little over 3 cows per hectare, I think, of the platform. And he's spreading 225 kilos of N per hectare across that milking platform, but 25 kilos of that is in the form of slurry. So they looked at the whole what's gone out there in terms of, he's recording everything in pasture based, and slurry is providing 25 kilos. So 200 kilos of N is what he's doing, and he's growing 15 ton of grass. So top class performer, and he's got no clover, which is the funny thing about it. Now, you know, why is someone winning a sustainability award, I suppose, that hasn't got clover? But in fairness, he's on the journey there, you know, so he's putting it in. And when he does that, I'm sure he can probably drop another, you know, 20, 30, 40 kilos of bag nitrogen off, and he'd be really sustainable in that case. But yeah, so he's like, I mean, look, I called it, the headline, I think, in the journal the other day was masterclass in simplicity, like, and because it is, everything he is doing is really nothing groundbreaking, but it's still took him about 15 years to get there. You know, he's farming his own right for 15 years. Really good on grass, he's budgeting, he's walking weekly, and he's using the figures, I suppose, to make sensible decisions. He's thinking ahead, using the mats, right good herd of cows as well. He's breeding for fat and protein percent for a long number of years. He's got average 3.9% protein this year in his cows. He's
highest price paid. Are you, what kind of solids per cow and what feed going in it?
So he did 520 kilos of mixed solids sold to Dairy Gold Co-op last year. He fed 750 kilos of meal, and he's got the highest 1% milk price in Dairy Gold. So I think it's just a little shy of 39 cent a litre he got last year.
Okay.
Which is about 4 cent a litre over the average. Like, so, you know, like, he's sickened in one sense that he's not a Carberry supplier. Even though a lot of his neighbours are Carberry suppliers, he's the furthest west, I think, that Dairy Gold go. But like, he's making up for it big time in terms of the fat and protein percentage he's generating from his herd in order to get the higher milk price.
Yeah, I mean, I know you're between farms. You're up in Northern Ireland, Aidan, at the moment. Like, I mean, we've Dairy Link webinars coming up from farm walks up there next week. Like, I mean, it's a different scenario up there in terms of the type of cow, in terms of that whole fat and protein piece that hasn't moved on at all relative to some of those guys like John Galvin. Like, we'll say they're increasing their solids and a kind of a more fertile cow, probably. Like, you know what I mean? The difference is something serious. Now, I know it's a different system in some farms, they're autumn calving, etc., that kind of thing, but the basic ingredients are different too.
Yeah, but the incentives aren't there, Jack, to the same extent that they are down south. And it's incentive driven. Like, I mean, unless you're going to put the emphasis on generating fat and protein in the milk payment system, I mean, what reason have farmers got to change? Like, and the funny thing is, I mean, in terms of the product mix, sure, it's very similar to what the Dairy Golds are producing in Northern Ireland. Like, they talk about liquid milk, but, you know, the products are generally processed into other forms of dairy products. So fat and protein is essential for it. But it's the system here is different. And it's making, you know, it's driving a lot of decisions on farms that aren't really made on a profitability basis. We look at the industry as a whole, and it's very slow to change. Look, I mean, it's on the Dairy Gold, the Dairy Link webinar will be on next week and the week after. I mean, look, very high yielding herds, 8,000 litre cows, producing very low levels of fat and protein relative to what's achievable. And it's all down to genetics that's in the herd.
Yeah.
So yeah, they've a long journey, you say, to go to get to where John Galvin is at, but that's probably not the journey that they're on either, to be fair. They're, you know, it's very much about maximizing the resources that they have in the current system that they have. And like, you're talking about 9 month calving period, you know, it's a lot of work, Jack. And sometimes that's missed, you know, a lot of that work is missed in terms of, it's not reflective in the benchmarking figures. But these farmers up here, they work very hard, and you know, it's a kind of a labor of love in many cases, but, like, you know, there's a cost to that too in terms of lifestyle and workload and all that. But, like, I mean, look, it's a, it they've still made great progress, and that's seen in terms of the amount of grass that they're growing now, and their utilization of that grass has improved an awful lot, and their farm cost has reduced as a result, so they are making more profit, which is good to see.
Right, Aidan, thanks for that. Speaking of different systems, earlier I had a chat with a dairy farmer, Cathal Moran, from just outside Kilkenny, and Zoe Kavanagh, the chief executive of the National Dairy Council, where we talked biodiversity, nitrogen, clover, and lots more.
Yeah, yeah, we're from a small little area called Skjokvashteen, and I suppose from a hurling point of view, we'll always have a bit of bite. There'll always be a sting in the tail, no matter how it goes.
Cathal, talk to me in terms of, give listeners and watchers, I suppose, a feel for your business and what exactly it is, just to give us a kind of a feel for the business in terms of what you do.
Yeah, I suppose, listen, we're dairy farmers, we're spring calving, nothing special in terms of what we do from that point of view. We've grown a lot over the years, naturally enough, but through the quota regime and since. I suppose ultimately the key for us as we go forward is sustainability, but the sustainability in all that it means, and that includes the person, includes the family, includes the farm, includes the whole unit as we move on.
So Cathal, I'll say to you, you're one of these, I suppose, examples of people have said, like, the dairy and dairy expansion and all this growth has caused problems and is the cause of a lot of these problems in terms of water quality, etc., and that kind of thing. I mean, so you've expanded. Can you, I suppose, explain in terms of, I suppose, how the different elements of that fit into your business, like the biodiversity, like the sustainability, like you talk about in terms of even labour sustainability, like the kind of clover. Let's just like go through some of the issues. Take biodiversity for a start. Like, I mean, in terms of how you manage that or what you're doing on the farm.
Yeah, I suppose we're all learning the whole time. That's number one. So this is a point in time. No difference in 10 years ago or 30 years ago would be a point in time. And hopefully in 10 years time, all of us would be a lot more knowledgeable and all of us would be doing a lot better. But I suppose in recent times, there would have been periods where, we'll say, you would have been burning off around hedges, around underneath wires and stuff like that. Just a simple one. Like, our vision, our picture of what we like to see has changed, because now what do? You go around with a strimmer at worst, and that's it. And you leave things in as natural a way as they can. Yeah. Our vision of cleanliness and tidiness has changed. I suppose even last winter we sowed wildflower seeds. Now, okay, we'll qualify that to maybe that's not the ideal when you see the issues that brought in terms of importing different weeds that we don't want here. But like it has, our picture, I think ultimately it's a picture in our own heads, and what we envisage as being nice will move and will change over time. No different than somebody's idea of a perfect cow. It will change. There's no guarantee what's right today will be correct tomorrow.
Yeah. I mean, Cathal, so I mean, that's biodiversity. I mean, there's other things that you do. As you said, you're spring calving, so you're predominantly grass-based. Grass is the big part of your diet. Yeah,
grass is king. So we calve to grass. It's all the KPIs that your six-week calving rates, everything, days of grass, the whole that stuff. But, what have we changed there? We're probably not changing a huge amount. We're probably tweaking, would say, our mean calving date. And even within that, we're only tweaking it by getting more compact, not by changing our actually starting calving date. The other thing, what we have done there now, we're actually genomically testing all animals. Okay. So every animal in the place, we know the DNA of it. We can trace them back, but we can also breed them better going forward. Now, that might be only a small thing in terms of the carbon side of the house, but at the same time, it will breed better efficiency.
It will. So, I mean, that's sustainable from the animals that you're using. You're trying to not carry any passengers. Every cow has to kind of earn their way and has to be efficient in terms of the environment and in terms of what she's putting into your milk tank.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. And it's like you never stop, and there's never one area you focus on. It's everything has to be focused on as the full, as the big picture, and you pick off different things as you have time to focus on them, and you work away on them, and gradually the whole, it's like the rising tide, it lifts all boats, and you bring the whole thing with you.
Cahill, I mean, grass has been kind of this, I call it the mainstay, as you say, for your herd and for lots of herds and for Ireland Inc., we'll say, in terms of milk production. I mean, one of the big issues there is using a lot of bag nitrogen to drive that grassland system, like we'll say. But there's a move on, and I suppose has been evolving over the last 10 years in terms of trying to get clover incorporated into that grassland system so that you can kind of, I suppose, use less artificial nitrogen. Are you on that bus yet, or kind of where are you on that journey?
We were on the bus, and we probably came off it a bit. When I say we're on it, you're probably going back 15 years ago or that, when we would have been using it a lot. But, you know, restrictions on what we could do on farm at the time kind of forced us to look at that and use it. So we have a good bit of background knowledge in terms of clover. But it's only, I suppose, last year now, as we're kind of reaching our max here, just you're starting to go back, and all the outside ground will be fully clover within the next 2 years. And from next year on, the milking platform will start to switch over. Now, the one thing we haven't gone there yet, that's all white clover and that's all grazing swards. The one thing that's in the back of the head the whole time for probably 3 years now, but we haven't gone there yet. But I think we will make a jump next year, and that's the red clover silage swards. It has a place, needs a bit more mining, and you do need to get 4 years out of it to justify doing it.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't mind trying it just for that high protein feed for young stock.
Yeah, Cahill, what's important for clover and red clover and grassland is soil fertility. I mean, how long has that been on your radar, trying to get the N, P and K and the lime status right? Like,
yeah, well, I suppose it's been really on the front and centre since 2013. There was a bit of a drought that summer, and you were back in the height of the last throes of super levies and quotas and stuff at that stage. So, you know, you were juggling a lot of different balls to try and keep going the direction you wanted to go, and financially you probably weren't as clued in to soil fertility, even though you knew, and everyone always knows, soil fertility is a big thing, but we were probably skimping in terms of what we were doing. And I remember that year, at that stage it was every 4 or 5 years we were soil testing, and I remember at the end of that year doing a soil test, and the farm was after getting mined a bit, we were after running the place down. So pretty much since then, we've been soil testing every year. And while there's a lot of extra ground comes in, you know, you obviously have to soil test that immediately. Like, but we're almost on an annual basis now, we're doing it. And we'll continue to do that, because you'll get one bad soil test, be it good or bad, it throws out what you want to do and what you should be doing. And also you can target what needs attention and what you can cruise with, like.
Yeah, and that's what I was coming to next, in terms of, like, if you foresee a problem, and you, as you say, your soil tests flag the problem, in terms of recycling nutrients from your cows back onto those paddocks to make them more efficient, etc., in terms of slurry usage, are you able to kind of, I suppose, use slurry to a full extent, like, you know, or how are you managing it, like? Yeah,
not as fully as we'd like to. I think over the next few years we will change tack another small bit again, because effectively we've been keeping most of the slurry on the milking platform. Now, when I say milking platform, there's a good chunk of that would be closed for first cut. Up to now, it's getting smaller every year, but so you've been utilizing it fairly well there, and that was, we'll say, new ground when it came in recent years, so it needed a bit of attention anyway. But we will have to start moving it around to outside blocks, you know, and targeting it. So what we may end up doing there is putting a holding tank just literally to store slurry, to be able to draw with our ticks down to it and hold it and spread from there.
Okay, hold it there, Cahill, for a minute. And Zoe, if I was to bring you in terms of, like, you see what Cahill is doing in terms of his farming business. He's upskilling, he's training, he's changing the practices he's making. He's trying to make the best use of the kind of new technologies like clover and, you know, recycling nutrients from his farm. I mean, does the consumer that's, you know, slandering to a large extent livestock farmers and dairy farmers and blaming them for all the cause of all the problems, do they realize, I suppose, the effort that goes into a kind of a farm business and a dairy business like Cahill's that has grown, but you know, that is changing and constantly evolving? Do the consumers understand, I suppose, what happens?
Yeah, it's a great question, Jack, and actually it's interesting. Our research shows that 84% of Irish consumers believe that Ireland is a really suitable place to produce dairy because of its climate. So that's a really positive starting point, but when you get in under the bonnet of that statement, they don't know why. And this actually, I think, is the big opportunity for Irish dairy, is to build a bridge between what Cahill is doing on farm and what the consumer doesn't know today, which is the why. Why are we suitable? What's so good about grass? What is Cahill doing to make us sustainable in the longer term? And therein lies our communication opportunity. So I guess the job of the NDC and even within the European Milk Forum is to actually start a dialogue between the dairy sector and the Irish public, educating them on what it takes to produce really high quality dairy off a grass-based system. Now, part of the challenge within that is language, comprehension, relatability. You know, that there's a lot of conversation that we will have within the agri sector that makes sense, farmer to farmer. But when you're talking to the Irish public, you know, you need to make sense of that in the same way as a cardio surgeon would make sense of, you know, his or her procedure on a patient. So making sense of it is actually drawing an analogy with the likes of gardening. You know, how do you find the right place to put the right plant in the right soil to get the right result and enough water? And how do you do it in a way that is, you know, sustainable? So I think Cahill, as I say, is a prime example of just sharing with us what he's doing in grass, what he's doing with soil, the considerations about biodiversity, the work being done around water and protecting waterways. Yeah. And a lot of that is not getting sufficient airtime with the Irish public. And obviously the climate change agenda, when you go at a very, very top level and you just talk about agriculture and emissions and miss the whole broader point, which is, there's an action plan, it's going to take time, but off a grass-based system, we're actually the best small dairy producing nation in the world. And if we don't produce here in Ireland and it's produced somewhere else on a global level, that's bad. Yeah. So I think our sort of, what should I say, body of work that must be done to almost reflect Cahill's effort and to actually do justice to the work that dairy farmers are doing is to find a way of communicating that to the public. We're not trying to turn them into expert farmers, but we do want to inspire trust. And what we can see is they're very trusting of the fact that Cahill is a food producer of highly nutritious products. They get that. And actually you could stop someone on Grafton Street or on Shop Street in Galway and they'll talk about calcium and protein. They'll tell you why. You stop that same individual and ask them about grass-based dairy farming, and they won't be able to tell you why, because we haven't told them. And that's probably the reason the sector is feeling on the back foot, because we actually haven't engaged with the public to tell them why they should, you know, be inspired and trusting of Irish dairy farming now and into the future.
Yeah. Cahill, you've been very upfront with us in terms of what you're doing on the farm. I mean, and I suppose we're not all about painting a rosy picture. Like, you know, I mean, is there, you have evolved as a business, as you say, you've grown, you've developed your business, you're changing your practices to make it more efficient every day. You're making changes. Like, but is there one piece that you felt you got wrong and that you decided to change and that you decided to kind of evolve as the business has grown to make it more sustainable for you as an employer and an employee and working on the farm in your own respect? Is there one piece that you have changed, I suppose, to the benefit of the business overall over the last number of years?
You've been hard on me now, Jack. I don't think so. I think it's evolution, like in its best possible way, because it's constantly tweaking. There's also a game of catch up at times in terms of more in terms of capital items and capital expenditure, because you're constantly tweaking. Like if I go back, say, to we put in the last, we'll say, lagoon. There's a couple of lagoons here as well as slurry tanks and stuff. Say the last one went in and did tail end 2015. So prior to that, on paper, we had enough slurry storage.
Yeah.
Okay, which was grand and all the rest and ticked all the boxes. But in practice, when it came to getting through the winter and being in control of what slurry is an asset when it's in the lagoon and when it's spread properly, it's an asset. But if you spread it incorrectly, it becomes a liability both to you and to the environment. But I suppose what we did at that stage, we put in a lagoon many times size or bigger, put in capacity many times bigger than what we actually needed. So now we have total control of slurry. You know, and even this year, we didn't spray it until March. Like, you know, whereas before you were looking at dates and you were trying to get to a date. And, you know, but, you know, that's probably one thing to kind of flip-flops over and back. Yes. You're taking a few boxes now.
Exactly. And that's kind of where I'm coming at, like in terms of like, there's a discussion among farmers at the moment in terms of the nitrates and what's happening there. And I suppose like it's the goalposts are kind of changing to an extent. And I call it, getting stricter in terms of what you as a business can do. And I suppose you have to keep up with that kind of changing space. Like that's kind of where I'm coming from. Yeah.
Yeah. And ideally, the way I'd always say it, one party, you never react until legislation is written and there. Mm. But at the same time, you're constantly reading signals and reading what's going on and seeing what's going on and what a report saying and what's this saying. And you try and be ahead of the curve in terms of how you plan, because you're planning so far out in advance as much as you can.
Yeah.
But you take, just as one example, say here we would have had water courses fenced off as part of the course anyway.
Yeah.
But last autumn, under the review of the nitrates irrigation, they decided, okay, you have to be a fence a meter back. And up to, I don't know, was it a month or two before the date when that legislation was due to be enforced, existing fences were okay. They were grand as long as they were there. And next thing, we had to move them. Like, you know, correct. Right at the point in time, like where you haven't time at that stage to actually do it in advance. But going back to the story one, we didn't touch on our nitrogen when you mentioned it there a while ago. Like say at this stage, we're probably 4 years. This is the fourth year of spreading protected urea.
Yeah.
And it's probably the seventh year, I think, at this stage of using less, which is low emission slurry spreading, which is your trailing shows, et cetera. Like, you know.
Correct.
You adopt. If it makes sense, you adopt and you use it. Like, and both of those would make economic sense as well as environmental sense.
Exactly. It makes sense for you as a farmer and for the environment. I mean, Zoe, that piece that farmers come in for stick for, like, you know, and the campaigning piece around farmers in terms of kind of, I suppose, for farmers to kind of get their message across that, listen, we'll work with you and we'll work with the environment because we need the playing pitch, the environment to be good for our business to continue. I mean, that's important. Farmers sometimes come in for a lot of stick for campaigning against such and such, but I mean, the rules are tightening all the time on these businesses, on farm business, on growing business, and it's not a lab. It's not in a laboratory. We're doing this in real life, in real farming businesses where there's real livelihoods at stake.
Yeah, I think what people must remember, this is a highly regulated sector because farmers are food producers, and the regulation, you know, can feel like a burden at times because it's very demanding. And I guess the positive of the regulation is in terms of food safety, in terms of quality, in terms of practice, it's ensuring that, you know, the sector is doing the right thing. And I think a large part of this regulation now is taking a long, hard look at environment and making sure that the environment is cared for as equally as the animal, as equally as the farmer's family and, you know, income. So what I find fascinating in talking about the sector is it's very innovative. And I think the view would be that, well, how complicated can it be? You just go out and you milk your cow. But the reality is this sector is embracing technology and innovation in the same way as, you know, Apple brings out a new iPhone every year. This sector is bringing new ways of farming the land and managing the animal every year. And I think what's going to be very encouraging for the future is all these changes that Cathal has outlined are firstly best in class. You look around the world and Ireland is not a laggard. It is incredibly progressive. And being honest, Ireland is the envy of the world off its grass-based system and off its rainfall. So I think what Cathal is outlining is a sector that's constantly learning, constantly looking to do things differently. And in all those changes, be it with the animal, be it with the land and water management and biodiversity, we're just getting better. Now, that feels lost in translation in media circles. But I think if the sector takes time to actually showcase these proof points and be, what should I say, more transparent, I think the collective understanding will be achieved at Irish public level. And at the end of the day, we should be unbelievably proud of what we do because we are unrivaled. And that's not being far-fetched in saying it. I mean, I've traveled and you've traveled too, Jack, and you look at different systems every day of the week, you'd be proud of what we do here in Ireland. And also proud of how farmers on the ground are embracing change. And I think that change element is not understood within the Irish public. It's viewed as a sector that is standing still, but that's truly not the case. And we've got to be more progressive in getting that message across.
Correct, agree. Cathal, last word to you. In terms of the innovation and the change that has happened on your farm, we'll continue to see more innovation. We'll continue to see more change on your farm in the next year, over the next couple of years, I suspect.
Yeah. I hope you will continue to evolve. You're always looking around. You're always listening. We're part of the Signpost program here for the next few years. And you know, I think we'll learn from that as much as anything else. Like, you know, just you're talking to different people and you're seeing different practices or different research pieces that are ongoing. But the one thing, I suppose, when you look at this whole area, like, and you listen to some of the commentary from the outside, a lot of it isn't looking at the big picture. It's not looking at the socioeconomic element of it. Like, if you look at any sector, and it doesn't matter whether it's dairy or going to cars, going to any area, you know, the margin per unit of output actually narrows over time. That's just a natural, just go back 20, 50, 100 years, that margin constantly. So how do you continue to sustain your income from it and sustain where you are and where you're living and where you're working? And that's through productivity gains, you know. So how do you do that in a sustainable manner, which ticks all the boxes? It's by being allowed the freedom to operate away in a proper way. Right. And that means that you can actually continue to hold your numbers, grow your numbers if it suits your farm.
Yeah.
But basically, you know, where you hear this talk of cutting numbers or this needs to happen or that needs to happen, a lot of it is looking at one item in isolation. It's not looking at the big picture. It's not looking at the potential of carbon leakage, the potential of a loss of regulation on the actual food that's produced, you know, the safeguards that are in place. And like, you just, I think that big picture just has to be constantly looked at and kept in mind as we move forward.
Right, folks, that's it for another week of Farm Tech Talk. Thanks for watching and indeed thanks for listening. Thanks to all our own specialists and indeed dairy farmer Cathal Moran and Zoe Kavanagh from the NDC for participating. If you want more Farmers Journal webinars, go to ifj.ie/webinar, including the full nitrates webinar that we just discussed and indeed the recent Rights of Way webinar. You'll get them there. Remember, you can listen to the show on podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back again next week. Until then, stay safe and stay farming.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.